Good morning. Just a quick word on the procedure that we will follow this morning. This is a special two-hour program, an hour longer than our usual one-hour program. And Stefan Schubert will open with the first presentation, and then we will have questions and answers directed to and from him. In order to save time during the day, I would like to give brief introductions of all three of our speakers at this time. I'll count on you to keep in mind what I say about the later speakers and not lose it from mine. We're talking about this morning two topics. The first topic is, are successful organizations in Islamic cultures fundamentally different from successful Western organizations? And addressing that question will be Stefan Schubert, who is here on my immediate right, who is the managing director of Tajuri Limited. He was educated in both business administration and mechanical engineering. He has served as chief executive officer of the Dubai International Financial Exchange. He created there a complete capital market, including the exchange, the clearinghouse, the registry, and settlement facilities. His staff for that organization he recruited from 22 nations, so it certainly is an international organization. His work with many of the leading exchanges in the world is what prepared him to undertake this path-breaking initiative in the Middle East. A word about Tajuri Limited. Mr. Schubert set this company up in 2005 as a vehicle to channel investment into Sharia-compliant and ethical investments. It's the first investment company to offer investment opportunities to all faiths. Then in the second half of our morning, we will consider the second topic, which is, should and can new transcultural leadership structures and models emerge between the West and Islamic cultures? And addressing that question will be first Dr. David Martin, who is the founding CEO of MCAM, Inc. David Martin has a PhD from the University of Virginia, where he has served as an assistant professor in the university's medical school. He was a founder and CEO of Mosaic Technologies, an international technology transfer company. His latest venture, MCAM, is recognized as the international leader in intellectual property-based financial risk management. A Batten Fellow at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration, he has served at all levels of government and business in establishing standards for auditing patent quality. And he will then be followed by Mustafa Ismail Sarhank, who is a graduate of the American University in Cairo and is a postgraduate scholar in the related fields of religion, psychology, and leadership. He served as chair for many years and now is the honorary chair of the Sarhank Group for Investments, which is a regional holding company with headquarters in Egypt and Geneva. He specializes in several diverse international business sectors. Under his leadership, the earnings of the companies managed by his holding company increased from a base of $150 million a year by a multiple of 14. I think a lot of us would like to get him to manage our money. He recently turned the leadership over to a younger brother so he could devote more of his time to long-range strategic planning. Finally, I would like to introduce and recognize our colleagues from the Darden Business School who were the real brains behind this conference and the driving force. Sherwood Fry, who is seated over here, a friend of many years, is a professor at the Darden Business School, and he and Jason Clifton, who is seated here in the corner, really originated the idea of trying to bring some folks from the Middle East to Charlottesville to address these questions of cross-cultural business practices. So having given an introduction and recognized our colleagues, let me introduce, to give the opening talk, Stefan Schubert.
Thank you, George, for the kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here. We already had, over the past few days, quite a lot of interaction regarding the subject at hand this morning. I'm really honored to add my experience on leadership in organizations in Islamic countries to this discussion. During the past few years, I was part of a project which I consider the highlight of my career. This is not to say that it's downhill from there, but it certainly was a rather significant one. Over 3 years, I ran a project in the financial industry, which happens only once in a lifetime. And it happens in an environment with a different mentality to the one that I grew up in. So at the heart of this project, there was core question of the presentation today. It's the leadership challenge. But before I introduce you to the project and my experience with it, let me clarify a few things. One, my presentation covers the success and partly failure, and if it's only in part, of organizations. And two, I have to give a small disclaimer, the small print of my presentation, so to speak. I can speak to the United Arab Emirates and to the Emirate of Dubai in particular, and from my personal point of view, yet that does not mean that all Islamic countries work the same way or that all Islamic companies work that same way. Now, you will remember that the Middle East, while it's the cradle of Islamic religion and culture, is by no means the largest Muslim area by population. Just across the Strait of Hormuz is Pakistan, 170 million Muslims, or five times as many as the Gulf states. And then there is Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, the latter being the largest Islamic country with 86% of its 220 million population being Muslims. And surely, these cultures, these ancient countries, differ from the Middle East. But as these are countries which are equally alien to many of us, let's take another benchmark. The United Kingdom, France, and Germany have 15 million Muslims, about eight times as many as the United Arab Emirates. So, therefore, my presentation covers a very small but very active part of the Islamic world, a part that has been a trailblazer for changes in the region and way beyond the region. So enough about the disclaimers. Let me go to the experience now. And the journey to the United Arab Emirates and to the Emirate of Dubai, I would like to start right here in Virginia, simply to give a better benchmark. For us to better understand the surrounding political and economical frameworks which enable the businesses there, it is helpful to benchmark some of the structures against something that is much closer to home. So please bear with me for a few minutes and consider the following. Virginia comes up with an interesting idea. We already have a unique legal framework for the University of Virginia in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but now you declare the real estate around the university as a free zone. The reasoning for that is pretty straightforward. The creation of a free zone or special economic zone will create more business because it will attract more global players to your economy. There's nothing really new here, but this time around this idea goes a little further, quite a bit further actually. So to start with, the proposed zone attracts your business partners by lowering entry hurdles into the market. It retains the new players from abroad because you allow full foreign ownership, no matter what, as long as they abide with the laws. And inside the zone, you provide guaranteed preferred tax situation and you do not impose any restrictions to capital flows from profits out of the country. So speaking about general laws and taxes, the idea also includes a new legal framework. And with this framework, you drop any possible legacy and rewrite the laws, preferably to the best practice from all jurisdictions around the globe. And as your home language may not be the most widely spoken language in any longer in your business segment, you draft these laws, say, in Spanish, and make Spanish the legal language in your new zone. And to top that one up, you install a new court system inside this zone and hire international judges to create what's likely to be the latest and newest jurisdiction around the planet. Be with me a little longer. So you take your lawmakers from Virginia, you go over to D.C. and address the president and lawmakers there and say, you all, we like the federation, all right, but I think it's time to change and to add to the system. We want to create this free zone in Virginia. We believe federation has set a good laws, but we would like to change the commercial and the civil law to reflect our vision of the future and to adopt to a new international best practice. Therefore, we rewrite all of those. We have the new laws applicable in the zone, and we are fine if it's not just here, but if the other states can do the same thing. And you address the lawmakers and saying, can you please look at your federal laws, reflect our vision, approve the change, and change the Constitution? And the story ends that your lawmaker take a long, hard look and comply. Now, this, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is fiction at its best, don't you think? I truly believe that, too. This cannot possibly be the case, because there is a long list of thousands of caveats from my experience, and I'm absolutely certain that the group here will add another thousand reasons why it couldn't happen. But I just spoke in past tense, because you guessed it all right, it actually is possible, and it was done. Not here, as we know, but in another federation in the United Arab Emirates. And the way I described it was a bit straightforward. The reality, of course, was far more subtle. It took a very long 3 years from inception to reality. So are successful organizations or institutions in Islamic cultures fundamentally different from successful Western organizations? Yes, you would say. Something like this is not possible here. No, I would say I beg to differ. It's not different if you have an inspiring leadership, a state that is run like a company, and the values of proper business conduct are rooted in your culture and in your religion. You're just as successful no matter if you are Google with the motto, do no evil, or if you're an Islamic state that is run as a company. Before I get to the new zone itself, let me describe the country a bit more that made that happen. The state in question who achieved this is the Emirate of Dubai. It's part of the United Arab Emirates, or UAE. The UAE is a federation which consists of seven emirates, which are run by a ruler called a sheikh. Total population is about 4 million people, Dubai contributing about 1.4 million. Now, Dubai has a history of decades of creating new visions and to follow them through with real-life actions. The Emirate bases its recent wells, of course, as the other countries down there, on the oil riches of the region. But it itself has only little-known reserves. So if you look at their economy, if you look at Dubai's economy, it's based on trade, production, services, tourism, and only a single-digit percentage is contributed by oil and gas. And again, it's down to leadership style. The story goes about like this. The late ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Rashid Al Maktoum, asked how long the money flow from oil would last. And after the answer was 30 years, he immediately started dredging the Greek for larger boats to enhance the trade. He then started digging up the desert to produce yet another and even larger harbor, one of the largest ports of the world, Jebel Ali, simply to apply his long-term vision for the best of the Emirate. The vision to base the economy on the core strengths trade and not on short-lived riches. So yes, you would say, the leadership style does different, doesn't it? In today's markets, a lot of organizational institutions are driven by quarterly statements and not by long-term vision. Well, to a certain extent, I have to agree. I ran three exchanges, and if you look at many of the listed companies, particularly here in the U.S., that's the case. However, the backbone of the Western economy still lies, in my eyes, with those entrepreneurs and business leaders who look over the rim of quarterly statements and build their organizations for the longer haul. They may not envision decades as the Sheikh did, but quite a few leaders in the Western societies whose views go beyond quarterly statements, beyond a fiscal year, or beyond an election period. Let me give you an example, again, something closer to home. The CEO, Wedelin Wiedekind, I like this name, of the sports car manufacturer Porsche, as you all know, had a multi-year battle with Deutsche Börse, the exchange, which he lists his stock on, because he was dead against using short-term vision, concentrating on quick quarterly statements and returns. The exchange even removed Porsche for a period of its time from its index because of this void. He despised the exchange's request for quarterly statements. He wanted to ensure that the company's prosperity and long-term vision is supported by real economic profit, which stems from successful business ventures and not from short-term views or an interest charge irrespective of the outcome of such ventures. Why do I quote this example? Well, Wiedekind lives in a solid Christian-based environment in Germany, yet the value he bases his company on are also the spine of Islam's encouragement of profit from successful business ventures. So, thus, the basis for his vision for Porsche and Dubai's vision for their emirate are actually very similar. Not a big difference there. So let us go back to Dubai and see how the emirate is run today. The current ruler and son of Sheikh Rashid is Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. Sheikh Mo is as known to most expats. So for a little over a year, he's also the vice president and prime minister of the United Arab Emirates. He has taken his father's vision further, proving once and for all to his people that man's reach is wider than his grasp. The way he works resembles very much the way companies are run. Being a head of a state, he calls his office the executive office. He is frequently referred to as the CEO of Dubai. The state finances are looked after by a CFO. And the state enterprises were regrouped to what is now known Dubai Holding. Dubai Holding is run by a management team comprising of the heads of the companies in its portfolio and headed by chairman. And within this group, you find successful organizations. Let me give you some examples. Dubal, the world's largest single aluminium smelter. Hotel Group Jumeirah, with its iconic seven-star hotel Burj Al Arab, which you certainly have seen. Or take Emirates Airlines, an airline that expands its operation with one wide-body aircraft per month for the next 8 years. And finally, Dubai World. I mentioned the port Jebel Ali, Dubai World, who owns Inter Alia, this port in the desert. I have to say I'm still impressed by what this country achieves. All of these companies do not differ from our Western-style company. Some of them are run actually by Western executives, as a matter of fact. And those who are run by locals enjoy a leadership style from people which were trained in Europe or in the US. So what Dubai has done is to take their values, combine it with a stringent application of world-renowned management, and fused it with their vision. It's easy, isn't it? Actually, not really. The Emirate is run as a company by a visionary ruler who has a rather difficult task at hand. He needs to develop his Islamic country with very limited human resources. Why do I say that? Dubai has only somewhat over 200,000 local population, but his vision calls for a population of millions. So therefore, the country needs to expand, preferably without losing its roots and values, its identity, by attracting an international workforce to make up for the gap. Now, how large is the gap? Consider this. In 2005, just the latest figures came out last week, in 2005, already 97% of the workforce were expatriates. Not just from the region, but from all over the world. So they work in an Islamic country which tries hard to keep its identity despite the international influx of people from many different countries and cultures. If there is a difference between companies and institutions here and there, it is likely within the workforce composition that you will find it. The headline of the conference asked us to speak about differences in successful organizations, and I mentioned it earlier, it's also valid for unsuccessful ones too. Success and failure, as we know, is two sides of the same coin. And in all companies and institutions, some things go wrong. First, let us look at the fabric of management in these companies down there. There are quite a few expatriates in leadership roles in the country. I was one of them. But there's always a very strong element of local presence. So the necessity, and it's a necessity to keep the country's identity, it simply demands this. This local element is a tight-knit group of people which is part of the effort to ensure that the country's identity is ensured. For expatriate management, it is very difficult to become part of the inner circle of top government companies or institutions. For the outside world, these organizations seem to be only a success story where little or nothing goes wrong. But if you're part of the team, you find there is as much failure within these success stories as there would be right here. So the main difference is that the vision is so grand that all unsuccessful iterations do not matter in the scheme of things, as they would here, and they leave these companies and institutions well ahead of the international competition. The second element is faith in the leadership and in the information flow out from the inner circle. I have yet to find another country which, in general, will keep their internal challenges and failures so quiet. Just to pierce this particular veil and to fully understand the reasoning for particular decisions may very well be impossible for the outsider. Hence, certain decisions have to be taken on board and dealt with in a different manner than we would deal with it here in the West. You're not questioning these decisions as you would here. You are not challenging the same way. You will actually be hard-pressed to find any acknowledgement of these things that go wrong. They simply go differently. And the decisions become a matter of fact of the continuation of your project. So that was a long story to describe the way from the free zone that I mentioned at the outset of my speech. I want to use this particular project to show in a bit more detail how interaction works. Audacious, overconfident, these were the words that came to mind when I was reintroduced to this project and to the concept of a new financial center in Dubai in 2003. It is a rather grand vision to build a new international financial center from nothing, from scratch. The described project that would not work here in the US, but in the UAE, is called the Dubai International Financial Center. It was perceived in 2001, actually start working 2002, 2003, and it is, at the heart, it's a real estate project, $5 billion size real estate project, about 1.5 times the size of London Docklands district. Consider for the moment this square mile as a mini country. The center's authority is acting as a municipality. The regulator, which is a member of the World Organization of Regulators, IOSCO, polices the commercial actions within the center. And then there is the DIFC courts, just recently, 2 weeks ago, enhanced with more international judges to decide over disputes. One of the biggest challenges to start such a venture is certainly not the vision. The biggest challenge is to find executives with the right set of expertise who are willing to share this vision and to move to the desert to make this vision a reality. And within the first couple of years, this venture had to go through some really rough patches. After initially recruiting the first set of executives from around the globe, the realizations of the vision led to some serious clashes between the individuals. Well, if you create an environment which demands your local and regional interest groups to radically change some of their behavior patterns, you're also in for a lot of friction. Let me talk about failure. In case of the financial center, it led to a very well-publicized dismissal of the leading initial regulator management by the center's CEO. This was a significant failure. But interesting enough, being a significant failure, this damaged the venture only for a short period of time. The clash of leadership, of values, of value definitions between regional and Western executives created an even stronger basis for the whole project for the future. It highlighted deficiencies, highly deficiencies of the system, and it initiated the eradication of them. And again, what seemed noteworthy difference between the leadership style was something that can be found in Western environments too. And as in Western companies, not institutions, I may add, corrections happen swiftly too. So, of course, this incident had also a major impact on the project that I was responsible for, Dubai International Financial Exchange, or DIFX, which is a 100% owned subsidiary of the Financial Centres Authority. And the DIFX, which is not just an exchange, but a full suite of capital market organizations, the exchange, the clearinghouse with the central counterparty, a settlement organization, a registry, and an academy I made at. And as one of the first projects within the financial center, we had to go through a laborious process to receive a license to operate. And it was not just the license from our regulator, but the recognition of the regulators abroad, which made this a very hard process. So the acceptance of international market participants is core of the concept of this exchange. And an incident like aforementioned dismissal did not make the task of creating this market any easier, to say the least. So the leadership challenge was taken in its stride and did not take long to identify the gaps and to introduce the change. And with a home regulator working to international standards on eye level with the FSA in the UK and with the SEC in the US, we have seen very high regulatory demands, higher in their stringent ways, more rigorous in their application of the rules. I had worked under European regulators, but this assembly of experienced local, regional, international regulators topped that experience. Difference in leadership style? Not really. The same will apply anywhere else when regulators work to common international standards and have to overcome the mentioned detours. So finally, the exchange was built, the license was received, and it went operational on the 26th of September 2005 with a bang. Not a trading bang. The bang was that it had not only achieved the setup in a short period of time, overcome all new obstacles, like the dismissals, but had attracted top banks from firms around the globe, Citibank to Deutsche Bank, HSBC to Credit Suisse. It had attracted 72 staff of 22 nationalities, including Emiratis, to make this vision happen. So all of them evaluated the concept of the center, the exchange. They were comfortable with the rules, the regulation, the laws, the management, and the leadership. So for an industry whose compliance focus is at best described as mega-conservative, their embrace of a business concept in this Islamic country that would challenge their views and procedures is a very good proof that the differences in leadership are too small to matter in the end. So we built the financial center and the exchange for a region which covers India in the east, Egypt in the west, Lebanon and Turkey in the north, and South Africa in the south. We're talking about a third of the world population that is attracted to this financial center. And it is way beyond the Muslim world, and it covers Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, and many other faiths. In closing, I mentioned earlier that Dubai acts as a trailblazer for the countries and the region. The financial center, ladies and gentlemen, in Dubai is possibly one of the more important initiatives that changed that region. If you look around, its creation has already initiated other ventures in the surrounding countries and opened for change. Now, I hope that the few examples that I gave you another insight into this business world of the Middle East that we usually don't see. Dubai is a very good starting point for anybody who is interested to do business in the region and who wants to experience for themselves that the leadership styles in general do not differ significantly from those in the West. Thank you very much.
Stefan, as I go to the back of the room to invite questioners to throw some good questions at you, let me prime the pump with one. You and I talked earlier this morning about the fact that your exchange was involved in raising the capital that would have financed the Dubai ports deal in the United States. It would seem to me that any company involved extensively in international business activities would need to have very finely tuned political radar at work, and yet it appeared that this deal, as soon as it became public, was a non-starter in American politics. Could you talk a little bit about what your international political intelligence efforts involve, how you go about assessing the politics of a particular international situation, and perhaps what went wrong in this case?
Well, let me be cautious about the politics, because I would have to judge these things a bit different. I mentioned the way how we set up the exchange, that it actually is meant to create for international companies in the region to raise capital to do and to help their international expansion. So when Dubai World created this Sukuk, an Islamic bond, and raised $3.5 billion to expand, to finance their expansion and to buy P&O. Of course, I was very happy because it was at that time, again, the world's largest, newest, what have you, a typical Dubai statement on the exchange. Thank you very much. But I did not foresee any of these problems because the deal that they actually created was with they bought into P&O, which is a UK company with worldwide port operations. And of course, I look usually at the positive side of things. The fact that for whatever reasons, the deal, that part of the deal was rejected for the US ports, it did one very good thing. It actually put Dubai on the map, on every newspaper in the US. And I'm absolutely certain there are a lot of people who didn't know where Dubai is. Trust me, when I first got there 10 years ago and I said, I'm going to Dubai, and said, you're going to where? And that was from Germany, so that was not too far. So I look at the positive side of things. Companies are able to raise capital on this market. They can raise it from the region. Our first IPO was over $3 billion. It was a Lebanese company. And the concept works, that there are political implications on one on some of these deals. That will happen. But I don't see this one as a major obstacle or a major hurdle. I just see that one as a blink, an event in the period of time in the development of this market.
I may be anticipating a question that will be discussed later, but I'd be very interested to know how a successful place like Dubai keeps its clerics in line. And that leads to another question. What is the division within this community or of the UAE between Shiites and Sunnis, and does it matter?
Oh, the second part of your question, I'm certainly not the right person to answer that bit. Let me put the challenge that I mentioned earlier is to keep the country's identity. I believe that this is the biggest challenge that particularly the Emirate of Dubai has, because it has such a huge amount of expatriate workers. 97%, ladies and gentlemen. The next largest country is Luxembourg with 68%, and then it drops down to the 25% range. So this is a major influx. However, a lot of those expatriate workers come from the region's countries and are actually Muslim. So you do keep a rather large Muslim population. And when you work on a day-to-day basis, and it is actually, you are in an Islamic country, so you hear the call for prayer, you live through Ramadan, and as a matter of fact, if I look at my staff, 22 nationalities, majority non-Muslims, quite a lot of them did fast. they did participate in that. So it is not so much keeping the cleric in line, so to speak. I think this country, the way how it's set up at the very moment, moves very nicely with this challenge and just opens up and embraces the change, which is more on the business side. And if you look at the business side, it's the ethical values of business, of the way how business is conducted, which is actually pretty close to ethical values that we have here. Mind you, there are some who not abide to these rules and are as ruthless as you will find them over here. It works either way.
The next questioner is a retired physician, OBGYN, from the University of Virginia Medical School.
Thank you for an excellent talk. I was sitting here wondering about the status of women in your country, particularly local women and women who came in to work in the effort that you so well described.
Very good question. Thank you very much for that. I mentioned that the UAE acts as a trailblazer in the region, and that works nicely. I think the easiest answer is, of course, that the Minister of Economic Affairs is a woman. And she's a pretty tough lady, I should add. You will find women in all ranks, in all industry, be it in public organization, institutions, or in private. Those who come to the region to work there, is actually no difference whatsoever than you would find if you go to New York or you go to London. And you find a very nice fusion of the very strict adherence to the Muslim society and those which are actually not even based in religion, like a fully veiled, like you have in Saudi Arabia, right next to normally, typically dressed Western women. All in the same shop, even in the same organization. I had not fully veiled women, but everybody who's wearing the abaya and the headgear working for us. And it's exactly the same thing. My assistant was from Egypt, where you have the headgear very, very tight, but very fashionable. Every day another color. I can only say it was just like it is a fantastic working environment. But again, Dubai is a trailblazer, the UAE is a trailblazer. You will see that the conservatism that you have, and mind you, this is not only in Muslim environments. I mean, if you go back to the rural areas in Germany, you see the women wearing a scarf very tightly too. So there's no difference there. But it opens up, and it opens up the people's minds to what's going on elsewhere in the world. And you have all of these cultures coming in and helping to develop that area. It's a very interesting experience. By the way, one last question, one last comment. From my understanding, there are more nationalities in the UAE than there are in the UN.
In view of the Quranic prohibition of interest, how does the banking community, which must be very active in Dubai, handle, if you will, gaining their profits?
Firstly, I should add that the concept of Islamic finance and Islamic banking is actually a rather new one, which only started about 25, 30 years ago, as a concept to see how traditional banking that was imported from the West could be added to comply with the moral standards that you have coming along with the religion. So out of the 42 banks you find in Dubai, there are only like five which are Islamic banks. The others work the regular way with interest and the way you have it. There are quite few which actually change. Now, this whole interest thing is something that is always on top of people's mind. But if you look at Islamic finance and you just rename it a little bit, you will be surprised how close it is to the ethical standards you have somewhere else. I mentioned one thing. The reason of riba or having too high of an interest stems from the fact that the profit should be derived from a business venture, from an underlying asset. That would make quite a few of the bonds that our government's put out these days obsolete, wouldn't it? Actually, this part is, in the end, you end up with an Islamic bond called Sukuk, will come up with a price, with a yield, which is similar to a regular bond. It doesn't have this price tag to it, and it has something else. You share the risk. The element of the philosophy of the religion is that you share the risk, that you have an underlying business, and it's very solidly rooted that you should make profit from your business ventures. So I think it needs to go down people's mind that it's just not having interest, and by the way, the Bible says the same thing as far as I remember. It's just considered differently that you actually have to make profit from your venture, and then you share the risk, the upside and the downside from it. The banking system, of course, has a few challenging elements, particularly, and I may quote Oman, country, neighboring country, in early 2000, 2001. I spoke to a bank down there and says, we don't have Islamic banks in Oman. I said, why not? The central bank is dead against it. I said, that's very interesting on a solid Islamic country. And why? Didn't take long. I mean, I'm a trained banker. It took a while, but only like 5 minutes. The central bank's core instrument to regulate your banking industry is interest. So as all of these economies down there were created by adopting the standards that we brought in from the West, you have quite a huge challenge to actually change to something which is not interest-based and take the major instrument away from the central bank to run your economy. So there are quite a few challenges associated with it.
To set up your exchange, how long did it take from the thought process of starting it to completing it? How much did it cost and who financed it?
The first ideas, I got involved in it in summer of 2001. It really started taking off from my idea point of view 2002, 2003. I moved to Dubai and we created the concept. I mean, I was alone then. So we then basically planned the whole thing. Because of the incident that I mentioned, we had to redo the plans once. And we were about end of 2004 when we had the plans ready and went out to go for vendors for the systems. We announced it on the 14th of February 2005 that we would have a market on the 26th of September of 2005. And then I had extended my vernacular on how crazy I am when I went around the world banks and saying, we're building an exchange, a complete capital market in 6 months. So actually it was a little more than 6 months, it was 9 months, but that was about the time from announcement to delivery, everything, including the building, I should add. The costs are in the low double-digit millions, is undisclosed. It's financed by the Financial Center, who is the owner of the exchange. It's not a public exchange now. There are consideration to open it up to public participation in the ownership, but that's probably a few years down the line.
Thank you for a really informative talk. My question has to do with the UAE company who tried to manage the port business in the USA. There was a lot of objection in the U.S. by just about every Tom, Dick, and Harry and everybody else. And the UAE government handled the situation very diplomatically and very nicely. But how was really the reaction of the people in Dubai, in UAE, for the rejection?
This is a very interesting question, because when you live in Dubai, you know things that usually do not make the larger press. Now, this aforementioned harbour, Jebel Ali, is one part of this Dubai world ownership, and they do expand globally, and they bought ports all over the world, and the operation of the ports, whether it be in Asia, be in Europe, and the US. What I should mention is, there is a fleet of the U.S. Navy just outside of Dubai. carrier battle group or whatever you call it. And of course, we know about that. It's like, you know, Iraq is 2 flight hours away, but, you know, they are there. To my understanding, two things. 90% of the supplies that go into this battle group, this carrier group, go through this very harbor, Jebel Ali. And to my understanding, this is the only harbor in the world where a U.S. carrier actually goes inside the harbor. So when this happened, oh, this is not safe enough, and it's the Middle East, and it's Islam, and it's I don't know what, all of these things, you know, you just sit there and say, well, hang on. Don't they do resupply all of their navy right in this harbor? Don't they consider this one to be the safest place? So it was a bit of a stunner, let's put it this way. And most people just didn't know what was going on. It was very quickly being seen as opportunistic by a very few to use it for their own position. And I don't want to get into the political parts of that one. But it was rather surprising for us living there because I thought, well, hang on, this is such a tight relationship between the country and the U.S. There's such a tight relationship on security issues. That was really very difficult to understand. And I give you this, the government handled it very quietly, very nicely, and you know, just covered to make sure that this doesn't disrupt the relation between the countries. I was very impressed about that.
And now to carry us forward, I turn it over to David Martin.
I live closest by, and I have my colleagues who have come cumulatively from half the circumference of the globe away. So in a very unusual situation, I'm going to limit my remarks because what Mustafa and I have agreed is that it would be a wonderful opportunity for us to engage in a dialogue, and the dialogue is actually something that is not merely one of a Socratic method, but is actually to model something that we would actually advise is the best way for leadership to be not only defined but cultivated. And so I'm going to limit my remarks, and this will be a miracle if it happens, so I'm alerting you to a divinity moment. If, in fact, I keep my comments to 10 minutes, it will be truly a miracle, and we will be able to beatify somebody. But I want to address two questions at the very beginning of my remarks. The first actually happens to be part of a question that was asked before the break, and the second also has to be addressed as part of what happened before the break. Two questions, Sunni and Shia. And another question, Dubai Port World. I find it intriguing that we have created a society in this country where we actually are willing to characterize 1 billion people by 3 words. I'm going to add to it a fourth. I recall reporting with great enthusiasm that a Islamic finance product, which actually has a world first around it, the first ever intellectual property collateralized financial instrument, actually reviewed by an Islamic finance Sharia board, who were asked to issue a fatwa on their designation of this particular product. When I proudly announced that I actually had a fatwa I was looking forward to, I received, and I wish I was making this up, I received condolences wondering what book I had written disparaging the Prophet, wondering what I had done to defile a Quran, wondering how many people were out to kill me, and what precisely was the price on my head. I am not joking when I say the following. At that point in time, when I was looking forward to a fatwa being issued on Islamic finance for intellectual property to democratize capital in the Middle East and Asia, I in fact had a death threat from my own government. That death threat actually was presented in the following way. My company is responsible
to work with the United States Treasury on overseeing whether or not there are tax abusers in corporate America. I was advised a long time ago that a U.S. corporation should never find itself labeled as a tax collector or a friend thereof. I'm in good company. There was once upon a time another person that was labeled a friend of a tax collector. So I figured, what the hell? And in point of fact, I sat across the table from a United States senator who said, David, don't pursue this matter of tax collection and tax fraud, because if you do, you will die. You will be killed. Because what you're doing is actually calling into question the accounting statements of one of America's largest corporations. And he said, there's so much money riding on it that you'll die. Isn't that interesting? I'm looking forward to a fatwa from the Middle East when I have allegedly so thoroughly impaired the finances of a U.S. corporation that a death threat has been made on my life. If you want to know the passion for why I stand before you today, if you want to know why the passion for which I actually bring together dialogue all over the world, that's the passion. The passion is we should not look so far away. I do think it's ironic when we think of Dubai Port World that for 1 year prior to the closure of that transaction, the United States government approved that transaction. And truth be told, and unfortunately that's a bad habit, but unfortunately it is also the mark of leadership, not just in the United States, but everywhere on the globe. Leadership is sometimes speaking the truth, even if it is politically inappropriate and unpopular, which is something we seem to have forgotten in this country and many other places around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, if Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton had not been opportunistic about the Port of New York, we would not have heard of Dubai Port World. And I would ask you to take an ethical review of the financial transaction that actually occurred and ask yourself the question, did we do anything by creating the adversity between the United States and Dubai? And the answer to this was answered by one of the leaders of Dubai. When I posed the very question that was posed here, how are you going to deal with this? Isn't this a public embarrassment? And one of these great leaders, a devout Muslim, looked at me and he smiled and he said, David, we provisioned the ships of Napoleon and we provisioned the ships of the United Kingdom in 1815. We learned that when a ship comes into our harbor, the best mode of operation is to welcome them, to service them, to charge them fairly, and send them on their way. And I said, well, 1815, Napoleonic War, help me out with Dubai Port World. He said, David, the United States Navy's contract is coming up for renewal. That was it. That was the government's response to Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton. And everyone sitting in this room and everyone hearing the sound of my voice has paid for our arrogance in a Navy contract that got more expensive. Dubai didn't lose. We did. We lost. And we lost because we didn't understand that before you ask a question, the best thing to do is aggressively inform yourself. Let me say that one more time. The best thing to do before asking a question is aggressively inform yourself. Because some questions are not worth asking. Because the answer when spoken is setting a course that is the wrong course. We were asked to talk about leadership styles. And we were asked to ask the question, are Western leadership styles appropriate in Muslim countries? I'd like to give you a vignette in my past. I'm old enough or young enough, depending on your point of view, to recall the ordination of a bishop in my church in Pennsylvania. The ordination of a bishop in my church in Pennsylvania actually took place when three Bibles were placed on a platform in front of the sanctuary in the church. Inside of one of those books was a slip of paper. And the slip of paper marked the page in the book of Timothy in the New Testament that talked about the admonition of what it means to be a responsible leader. One of those books contained that slip of paper. And the candidates who might be bishop were invited to come forward and actually select one of those Bibles. The person in whose Bible the slip of paper was found became the bishop. It was called ordination by lot. It is actually a Western leadership style. It was actually a form of election that actually dates back to very early 13th and 14th century leadership in Europe, which is the birthplace of our modern Western leadership styles. It said that candidates that were worth selecting out of a group, who had differentiated themselves out of a group and were worthy of the mantle of leadership, could be candidates to lead, but divinity had to pick who got the leadership. Where we sit today is no different. Where we sit today is at a discussion point that talks about Western leadership and it talks about Islamic leadership. And fundamentally, we're not talking about anything that is different, because if you look at the first ordination by lot, you find out that it happened in the Middle East. And it happened in the Middle East 2.5 millennia before Christ, the first documented ordination by lot. What does that tell us? Well, what it tells us, if we look at this not as a religious issue, but a sociologic issue, is that people have to draw a bright line between the modern interpretation of democracy and leadership through the electorate and what leadership truly was about in the first place. Leadership was not something that an individual could have merely by desire, merely by personal aspiration. The current CEO of the Dubai International Financial Center, who is a delightful young man, Nasser al-Sha'ali, has in his name something that I find a compelling metaphor for our dialogue today. I didn't know what al-Sha'ali meant. So one time when I was sitting in traffic on Sheikh Zayed Road trying to get from one place to another, which you can't do, and I thought, I'm just going to ask finally, what on earth does al-Sha'ali mean? Every name means something. And Nasser told me that his family name is derived from a name that meant the builder of the great fire. And I said, the builder of the great fire, that's very charming, that's very poetic, it's a wonderful thing. I love that name. I'd love to have been named the builder of the great fire. But then I asked him, well, what was that about? He said, well, it turns out that the tribe from which my family came actually came to recognize that the most important place in the community was around the fire. So when you are traveling across the sands and you are traveling across from all the trade routes and everything else, people would come together at the great fire, and his father's 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 father, somewhere back father, happened to make great bonfires. Hence his name, al-Sha'ali. The builder of the fire. The al-Sha'ali family is about to have a public offering. Very large business. Very successful business. Hugely successful. They build boats. They do all sorts of things. But where did the leadership come from? The leadership came from people seeing a trait in a person that happened to build a community. And the trait in the person that built a community built a reputation, and the reputation built, and over a period of time, the investment in making a great fire became a great name, became a great tribe, became a great leader. Was leadership the objective when the first al-Sha'ali made the first fire? No. It was not the objective. It was what was given by consensus of the people who recognized someone who invested in building something that the community valued. I would submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that a miracle just happened. This is not about Iraq. This is not about Indonesia. It's not about the Jakarta bombings. This is not about towers in New York. It's not about policies of people who aspire to greatness for sound bites. What we're talking about is leadership and whether Western leadership styles are appropriate in Islamic cultures. I would like to share the floor with my brother Mustafa Zarhank. And I would like to have him read to you a summary of what he shared with a group of us last evening. Because I'd like to have him tell you 10 commandments of effective business leadership.
It's always extremely difficult to talk after him. A, because English is his mother tongue, and B, because he's bold. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I will try to be as fast as possible so that I can give you room to ask questions, because I am adamant that you have plenty of those. So, please, after I finish, any question you would like to ask in any realm you think is important, just shoot it at me. And I will try to do my very best to answer it in a meaningful and intelligent manner. What I will share with you now is an email that I have written last year when I have deliberately abdicated my throne at the head of my holding company. Before doing so, I have insisted that I would create what I learned back in school when I was at the American University in Cairo about corporate governance, what our tutors have taught us in business schools, where we should divide between ownership and management, especially in family-run organizations. And because I was not seeking a leadership position a long time ago, my leadership role was given to me by my agonizing grandfather 15 years ago. He asked me to come over, and he passed on to me his ring that I'm wearing with the family crest and the helm of the organization. And from that time onward, I really started to ponder, how am I going to lead meaningfully a group of people made of 3,800 colleagues and to ensure that their livelihood is taken care of, and I lead them with values? So I took a retreat for a few months, and then I started to write down what I call the 10 commandments of a human being leader. And the 10 commandments, I have written them in an email as my last communique to my colleagues while going out of my operational duty as the CEO and president of Zarhank Group for Investment. And then I left the organization. So today I'm standing before you, ready to receive any job offer anybody of you would have. We all know that life is not necessarily smooth and that we do not necessarily get what we want or opt for, inasmuch as it is sometimes hard for us to comprehend the state of being. Believe you me, this is one of God's best gifts, and I will tell you why. Well, my dearest brothers and sisters in arms, it is simple. When we are born, each one of us is entrusted with a pot of fortune made of different partitions and filled with divine fillings. All pots, irrespective of their partition's mass, weigh the same weight.
And each one of us is given a set of feelings that always sum to 24 units. Some of the divine feelings cannot be altered during the course of our lives. However, others do indeed change, for they solely depend on our accomplishments and sincere nearness to Almighty. In our insatiable quest to attain higher grounds of prosperity and well-being, in our irresistible desire to better our lives, we tend to forget that in many instances we are focusing our energy to the wrong partitions and forego the ones we surely can alter. I am neither trying here to be philosophical nor saintly. The truth of the matter, I am so concerned about us all that I have decided to share with you some of my inner beliefs that did help me and still are very much so in my ongoing quest to become a better human being. First, I have to warn you that there is no single recipe for success. However, there are basic, intrinsic, and fundamental ingredients to success that I believe we must all share and have in common. I will start with few of my own that I was able to amass through my experience and from listening to the elderly and the more experienced generations. I can see in the room that the majority are senior citizens. And believe it or not, if we do not listen to you, this is going to be the beginning of the end. You have been there before us. We need to extend bridges with you, sit and listen to you, because you have been around. You have seen things that we did not see. You have experimented things that we never experimented. Therefore, we as the new generation need to spend time with you, listen with respect, and listen carefully to what you have to share with us. I will start with my 10 commandments, ladies and gentlemen. Number one, first and foremost, is the love of God. To believe in divinity is the start and the end, the center and the perimeter. The warmth of the feelings is so intense that one feels engulfed in lukewarm velvet. The joy and inner peace that one gets out of the relationship is so fruitful that it helps in accepting life challenges and mind-boggling divine judgments. The love of God is our beacon and torch when we are fighting the eternal battle of good and evil. Number two, love of parents, family, and friends. To cherish and honor one's parents is so sacred that God has spoken of it. There is nothing more important than family, for it is the root that one came from and the root that one will die within. The new generation, ladies and gentlemen, tend to put barriers between them and their parents. And I always tell to my kids, I was not a father before, so help me to help you. Let us extend an open dialogue so that I know what you want, and let me tell you what I see. Definitely the white hair that I have started to build up has certain value. So I would like to pass on to you what I believe should be done, but I never enforce what should be done. You have to follow, but be armed with my experience. There is nothing more important than family, for it is the root that one came from and the root that one will die within. As for friends, well, finding a truthful and honest friend is a jewel that must be treasured for life. This triangle concomitance is so important in our life, for it shelters us during the coldest of the nights and gives us the fuel to ponder, reflect, and meditate about one's life, accomplishments, and future prosperity. Friendship is very important. Friendship without ulterior motives. Friendship for the sake of friendship. I know Dave not because I want something from him. He knows me because he does not want anything from me. We know one another because we believe that our souls came together. Whether he is Christian or I'm a Muslim, this has no value whatsoever. What has bound us together is actually human value, the human value set. Number three, ladies and gentlemen, in the Ten Commandments of human being leader, modesty. To equally approve compassion towards God's different beings, whether made of flesh and blood, or simply stone and bricks, is of equal importance. In the process of elevating oneself to higher grounds of human supremacy, One must ensure that God created us in strata. There will always be somebody better, richer, smarter, more fortunate than us. And in the same line of talking, there will still always be somebody worse, poorer, dumber, less fortunate than us. Unfortunately, we tend to look at what others have, and we forgo to gaze on what we are blessed with. Sadly, it is us who allow Satan to infiltrate in our minds and poison our thoughts. It is us who allow the devil to play his dirty tricks and blind us from seeing the truth. We are our own weakest link. Number four, respect. It is inevitable if one wants to prosper, then one must come into peace with oneself first. One must acknowledge that all beings are equal and all demanded to be respected, and this is the basic reciprocity. Deference is a fundamental necessity if one is really serious to perform well in a team. Tainted feelings of superiority contaminate the demeanor of individuals and propagate toxic vapor in the air. Additionally, one must never forget that before one respects fellow human beings, one must respect oneself first. In that sense, one must be at all times vigilant in the way one behaves publicly as well as at home. One must be sure that whatever one does have repercussions that first defile oneself and go on to tarnish others around, and usually, quite unfortunately, the loved ones. Emphatically, since we are all citizens of our respective countries, we must revere this citizenship, even if we are not convinced of many things around us. It is this country that engulfed us during our childhood, puberty, maturity, and will still in our old age. It is the land of our fathers and forefathers. It is the soil that made us reach what we are today. And we surely have an obligation towards our motherland. Please hold it in the highest of your regards. Five, honor. Where are we without a sense of integrity, decency, morality, and righteousness? I am of the belief that one must live by self-esteem and dignity. I am of the belief that we must cherish our intrinsic gift of self-distinction and always strive to ensure that we deal with our fellow human beings as such, demanding reciprocity of reverential assertion. Six, quest for knowledge. It is a fact that there is nothing called perfect knowledge, nor I know it all. Perfection is an endeavor that one must have as a life quest. As we live, we amass know-how in different disciplines and expand the horizon of our knowledge. Life is a continuous state of evolution, and so is our comprehension of the worlds around us. Thinking that we know it all is the beginning of the end. Relentless journeys to acquire information is what makes us one a better human being. Seven, discipline. How would we conquer our inner selfish needs and wants without putting a rope around our desires? How would we elevate ourselves to incomparability to the norm if we seriously don't teach ourselves restraint and strict adherence to rules and regulations? How would we be stringent in the face of life's challenges if we were not accustomed to austere existence? Strictness, ladies and gentlemen, is a way of life. It is the fuel that stimulates one's raison d'être. If one wants to excel in life, one must set goals and objectives that one must aim for and discipline oneself to achieve them, all or at least few of them. That way, one would always be in a state of accomplishment and continuous inner satisfaction. Then I go into justice and trust. Those are two facets of one coin. Leaders must be just. They should not follow their inner affiliations. They should not have ulterior motives. They need to treat everybody on equal footage. Balance is of prime importance. I should not treat one of my colleagues better than the other simply because it happens to be a very nice-looking lady. This is foul. However, if I find that there is a very nice lady who is very good in her business, I will promote her. And this is indeed what I have done. My personal assistant was with me for the last 22 years. Today, she is at the throne of my holding company as the chief operating officer. She is 49 years old, older than me. She gives me the beacon when I needed a beacon. And because of her, I am standing today before you, full of confidence that my set of beliefs has always been checked by people. Everybody is not perfect. I make mistakes. And I needed somebody to tell me that you are wrong, without fearing of being fired. And those are the ones that I really have in my inner circle. Somebody to tell me that what you have taken as a decision was wrong. Review your decision again. And I do review it. Trust. I have many joint ventures with American firms. My joint venture partners have entrusted me with their money. I am obligated towards them to ensure that their money gets them a very high return on their investment, or what we call in business schools high ROI. Acronyms are so strong in business schools, let alone in the technology field, let alone in the medicine field. I always try to understand what acronyms are. But yes, indeed, ROI is very important for my American colleagues in the GVs, and they have entrusted me to ensure that it gets bigger and bigger every day, even if they are 6,000 miles away. It does not matter. They sleep at night knowing that Mustafa, down there in Cairo, Egypt, is doing his very best to ensure that their money is in good hands. Not only revenues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about expenses. When I travel, not as the GV manager of one of my GVs or what I used to be, I do not use my Gulfstream 4 private jet to fly. No, I fly business class, not even first class. Because, and I only do this when I'm doing transatlantic. Why? Because if I'm going to barge into this pot of money that they have entrusted me in, I need to have the dignity to stand in front of our external auditors and tell him or her, this is right. I did not misuse the funds. If I go for pleasure and I am would like to really go for a ride, I might take the Gulfstream 4, but not on company's accounts. Number 9, ladies and gentlemen, the voracious appetite to change destiny. And this comes first. As I have described above, there is a part in the pot that we surely could change, since God intentionally left it out for us to shape it the way we wanted it to be. What is mind-boggling, and that unquestionably proves Almighty sublime divinity, ultimate power and supreme foresight, is His divine knowledge of the outcome in all cases. This is mind-boggling. I choose to go left or I choose to go right, He knows the outcome. Ladies and gentlemen, we are already living what already has been written. It's done. The book is done and finished with. And this is the beauty of it all. When we come and ponder and try to understand, we really find that despite that verity, we are ordered to try to ensure that we are better. The entourage around us is getting better. And this is exactly what I'm talking about. Try to change fate. Can it be altered? Indeed it can. Because again, it's like a mold that can be molded. Then finally, and this is my final 10 commandment, if I strive to do something and it does not come, if I bid in a bid and I lose, then the first thing that I will do is to look inside me, to look at my colleagues and see where we went wrong. I should not blame the people. I should not blame the bidding committee. I should not just blame anybody for the sake of blaming anybody. I should first blame myself, study where I went wrong, then put corrective actions for tomorrow. If I stumble and I fall, I have to stand up again, because we are living in a jungle and we have to be very strong in carrying out what we have been actually born to carry, to ensure that the word of God will always prevail. And with this note, ladies and gentlemen, This was the final email that I have sent to my colleagues before stepping down from the chairmanship and become an honorary chairman of my holding company. Thank you very much for your time.
I'd like to start off with a question about the concept of merit. A friend of mine who is a very accomplished and very smart historian has determined that one reason the Ottoman Empire lasted so long was because they hired people to work based absolutely on merit, without consideration for country of origin or what religion they were. They just tried to hire the very best. And you have run a large company, family-owned. Would you please talk about your approach to hiring managers?
If a Muslim leader has the option or the choice of choosing somebody who has not a strong faith, but who is very strong in management and has traits of leadership, versus somebody who is very strong in faith but very weak in leadership, he will go for the first. And arm him with what we call the shura. Shura is very resemblant to democracy. I was asked before about democracy. Democracy, ladies and gentlemen, is a very relative term. Yours is different than the French, than the Germans, than the British, than ours. We want to talk about democracy, understand Shura, and I understand democracy, and we enter into meaningful debates. But any leader should have Shura counsel with him, or with her. Because the Shura is actually the layer that ensures that the leader is following the right tempo. If I go astray, the Shura tells me, go back. And here I would like to introduce to you two concepts that are very important in leadership. Servant leadership and guardian leadership. And those are two facets of one coin. To become a good leader, you have to serve. You have to be the shepherd of a flock. You have to serve the people around you. And do that with dignity and respect. Because only then you will have loyalists around you. And you should not be arrogant with them. Quite the contrary. You should actually serve them. And then you have to guard them against the wrath of the jungle, of the business world. Because believe it or not, there are very, very sharp people in companies who would love to suck the blood of small companies. Like this. On the merit of, we are large, we would like to acquire you. And if you do not say yay, then we are going to go for a hostile takeover. Isn't this the business world we are living in? But is this out of morality? Does this have values? And when they do this, the first thing that they do what? They fire people. Irrespective whether those people have families or not, have kids or not, have schools or not, these are things that are not being considered. And when the leader is being asked to do so, he answers again with arrogance and say, I have been entrusted by the stakeholders to take harsh decisions. Harsh? Are these harsh decisions? If I am in his or her place, I should commit harakiri, because it was I who made the mistakes in the beginning. It was I who took the company into the red. And before taking the company into the red, I should blame first myself and hang myself to the nearest tree. Not blame it to other people. This is something, by the way, that is not typical of the US, and it's not typical. I mean, it is typical of any corporation, whether it is here in Europe, in the Middle East. It is something that we always hear about and live.
I'd like to ask you a question about strategic planning. You've implied that you're now at a senior level and trying to provide some strategic direction for your corporation. There are a number of us in this room, including some of your friends, who believe that we're on the verge of an extraordinary time of change and disruption in the world, driven in part by energy and climate and terrorism, perhaps, and certainly financial disruption. I wonder, in that context of extraordinary kind of shift and uncertainty, how you look at the future and what you think is might be on the horizon and how you plan for it.
Strategic planning, number one, I do not work based on quarters. I cannot do that. You want results, you want sound plans, give me what the economists say, short, medium, and long term. I work on short, medium, long term. Maybe because I'm an economist by education, but simply I have 1 year plan, 3 years plan, and 5 years plans. And whenever I have a plan, I have an exit strategy. And the exit strategy, believe it or not, takes care of even the people that I will have to go apart from. I.e., if I need to ask few of the colleagues that they need to go and fetch other positions, I build in the model in the beginning a 3 months pay so that when they leave, they have a cushion of 3 months. And guess what? I even try to place them in other corporations, because I don't think that I will be able to sleep the night knowing that there is a crying kid who is incapable of getting his Milka food simply because his father was not able to get his paycheck. I cannot live with such guilty conscience. Therefore, strategic planning has to be done in such a way that we, when we do the strategy, we have to understand that there are endogenous factors as well as exogenous when it comes to the market around us, whether it is in the Middle East or in the international arena. We have to put plans in such a way that when things happen in a sour way, we have an exit strategy with multiple dynamic exit ways. Never the term static exists. Do you mean, Mustafa, that a strategy can alter? Could you believe that I have changed my strategy left to right during the course of 1 quarter? Simply because I took a strategy move that my second in command, the lady, told me, listen, disaster, retract. So I immediately retracted. And I had the courage to stand before my colleagues and tell them, I have taken you in the wrong path, let us retract immediately. And we retracted. And I think this is something that leaders should be doing.
I'm just curious, how would you assess the leadership style of George Bush?
I will answer you by saying the following. I am a person who respects very much the sovereignty of nations. And I do not pass any time, any judgment on anybody. In as much that I do not like anybody in this room to pass any judgment on my president, I do not pass any judgment on yours. He has his own mind, he has his administration. Populists have put him in office. Therefore, I'm not the right person to answer this question.
I have a grant. I was asked by the State Department when I returned from Tehran how to make sense out of President Ahmadinejad. I started by saying, stop talking about this as an Islamic issue and start understanding it as a Persian issue. Because it takes you 5 minutes in Iran to find out that they are Persians first, they're Persians second, third, fourth, 150th, and somewhere down in 175, they might be Muslim. They're first and foremost Persian. And if we fail to understand that entering in a dialogue, you have to first understand with whom you are speaking. You then understand that the strategy, once again, goes to my earlier comment. Before you ask a question, make sure you've actually done a bit of homework. My advice to the United States government on how to deal with President Ahmadinejad was the following. Turn off the TV for a minute. And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, look what he's doing. And by the way, I'm answering your question about our president. in how I'm answering this question. It turns out that what leadership has done lately is it does market tests. It says crazy things, rational things, highly imaginative things, terribly unimaginative things, and it puts its finger in the wind. And it says, how did the public respond? We have perverted the word leadership to mean putting yourself in front of a pack of people. And we have failed to realize that leadership is about being worthy of being followed. I will say that again. We have perverted leadership to saying that leaders are those who stand in front of an audience. And we've failed to understand that leadership is about being worthy of having people stand around and beside and behind you. We have the same problem that I had discussions with time and time and time again in Tehran. And this problem is not unique in the United States, it's not unique in Iran, and it's not unique in any part of the globe. The minute leaders abdicate leadership to public interest and public opinion polls, that, by the way, are more fickle than quarterly reports, much more fickle, you cannot lead. You cannot lead. As a matter of fact, both countries, both the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran, need the same medicine. And the medicine is to actually be willing to take on a responsibility that begins right here, right now, with the audience here assembled, which is to say, we will first honor those we respect and those that we fear by first trying to understand and then engage. Because no tactician in any empire at any point in time ever prevailed when they had faulty intelligence on the field. That hasn't been the case in history. It will not be the case in the future. And what we need to do is take the catalyst of the event that we have here and actually ask ourselves, why do we fear the word Sharia? Since when did the Afghanis get to define that term for all humanity? Since when did we say that one small segment of the Islamic world gets to tell the rest of the world what a fatwa means? The answer is, you all are making the investment in precisely what I talked about. And that is, educate oneself so that one can enter into a dialogue. That's something that we need. Our president may not be wrong. Our president may not be ill-intended. But our president merely stands in front of an organized mass called 238 or 250 million people who have lost their interest in being first informed. And the solution is in the Spanish Constitution. It's also in many of the Islamic laws. One of my favorite, Mustafa just shared again. We think it's austere, but you cut off a robber's hand in Islamic law for stealing. But if you continue to read, you find out that you can only implement the law if the world is just. Think about this. The leader can only carry out its law if it has done what it needed to do to make sure there was no want. If a person steals the loaf of bread, it's because the leader failed. And under a true interpretation of Islamic law, you can't chop off a hand unless everybody is fed. You didn't think about that, did you? The Spanish Constitution gives the right of the vote to every citizen who is literate, but then places on the government the responsibility to ensure that no one is illiterate. Is that a Western leadership style? Is that an Islamic leadership style? Is that a Judeo-Christian leadership style? What leadership style is that? Okay? That's what we need. And I'm very glad you asked the question, because we need to inform ourselves beyond the debate on the nominal market test subject. That's what our presidents have become. We need, in this country and around the world, to stop using the word leader when we're talking about market tests. It's two different things, and the reason why we are all here is because we believe in that, and we believe that it only starts when people are willing to say it.
I have a question for Mr. Schubert, please. First one, I have two, really. The first one is, given the situation in the Middle East, and I'll carefully dialogue that, how does the United Arab Dubai provide security that would attract people to invest their money there? And two, when I watched the History Channel show about Dubai, I was interested in what is the standard of living of the expats that live there, please?
Very good question, and I thank you for the question, because, of course, if you attract people, and I had this issue, the challenge to attract people from all over the globe to come to work there, and they're saying, and I was asked by friends, oh, you're going to the Middle East. And I said to friends in Frankfurt, saying, you're aware that Baghdad is closer to Frankfurt than to Dubai. So as a matter of fact, so when you get the geography right, I'm a very strong believer that if you get people to work together, to put their finances together in one area, that you actually create a rather peaceful environment. And as a matter of fact, I think that's what Dubai actually does. It creates an environment financially, from a financial center point of view, from a business point of view, where all and everybody comes to work and do business with each other. And that is an inherent part of the security that you can feel there. I'm not saying that they're immune, not at all. But I'm a strong believer that this works. And if the financial center, where I've been part of, really takes off and all of the surrounding nations use that one as their international arm to do business, I think it will stay as peaceful as it is. And, sorry, the second part was?
The expat labor.
Yeah, it's a very tough life down there. I must say that the working environment is such that it is close to being luxurious. As everything is new, you live in a very interesting environment. My favorite one is I do cook every now and then. If I go into a supermarket, I have the advantage of getting pretty much everything that is on the shelves here, what's on the shelves of Europe, from the Middle East, from India, and from Asia, and have a choice of food which just resembles the population, and it's stunning. And when I go back home as being Germany, I'm disappointed on how little I can actually find, because we are, of course, covered just with what our culture offers us at home. So it is a rather interesting environment, particularly when you look at the day-to-day necessities. And with this influx of people and the influx of culture coming along, so nowadays you have an increasing amount of concerts and shows and what have you. It's a very interesting place to live, and it's a very peaceful place to live. You're welcome.
I would just like to add one very tiny note to this. There's another side of the story, which is the construction workers. You can't have an environment where you have what is reported to be 40% of the world's cranes in something like 20 square miles, which is a lot of cranes, by the way. And you can't run 24-hour, 7-day shifts without an enormous, enormous number of people. It was very interesting that a group from the United Nations and a number of other organizations decided that the expat working conditions in Dubai were actually quite abysmal. In fact, people having
a number of safety issues, lodging, where it was very common to see 8 people living in a single dormitory room, living conditions that by any standard that the UN and other organizations viewed was actually quite unacceptable. Ironically, it was a quite unusual situation that it was in fact the expat workers in these very conditions that actually lobbied for the UN not to protest. You heard me correctly. Not to protest the conditions. Because it turns out that their advice to the United Nations was, please go where we came from. See what we left to come here before you make the mistake of actually assuming that these are bad. And by the way, this is no defense at all. It was merely the very people who were supposed to be the beneficiaries of this largesse of the international community said, please, before you protest Dubai, look where we left. Because it turns out that in a 5-year period of time, on average, the expat workers from Southeast Asia who come to Dubai to do the building actually retire and go home after 5 years and go into environments where their lifetime in 5 years has amassed more wealth than the sum total of everything they could have made in a lifetime. Does this justify inhumane treatment of people? The answer is no. But once again, and this is an important message to drive home, one has to expand one's horizons to ensure that by doing good, and by the way, I'm the first to work on affordable housing and I'm the first to build houses. I'm leaving in a couple of months to go build houses in Mexico for multinational corporations just south of our border that give us all our flat screen TVs at very discount prices. And unfortunately, we get that because we actually have people living in cardboard boxes south of our border by about 500 meters. I believe in changing that. But just as it is easy for me to actually look into someone else's living condition and say, that's abysmal, it's not the opulence that I might be used to, I need to actually do what we were requested to do by the Dubai expat workers in the industrial sector and understand from whence they come. And I find in that a very compelling closure. This conference was set up not to answer a question. This conference was set up to actually bring us together to begin a dialogue. We trust that in a very short window of time, we have given you ample reason to ask at least one question that CNN and Fox News have not asked. And with that challenge, I would like to thank you all for coming. I would like to thank Darden. I would like to thank personally Jason and Sherwood and George and Debbie for their tireless efforts. And I know I speak on behalf of my colleagues on this stage in thanking each one of you for attending this conference. George?
We are, of course, more than grateful to Stefan Schubert and Mustafa Sarhak for coming the great distance that they did. But in his modesty, David Martin did not thank himself, who really was the glue that held it all together and enabled the conference. So thank you very much.